good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune.
Go to any economics department in this university, and it's just a big vat of laced Kool-Aid.
From somebody else. And this we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 623 of Unwelcome Guests. Waking up and smelling the Kool-Aid. I'm Robin Upton. My inspiration for that title was the voice we've just heard, the forthright Chris Hedges, who in our second hour speaks on the suffering, the fallout of neoliberal ideology that he witnessed in the 2 years he's been researching his latest book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Now, that's in our second hour, because in our first hour we're going to be looking at the rise of neoliberal ideology and finance capital. How did we get to a position in which numbers on balance sheets were deemed more important by lots of people, more important than the health and well-being of most people in the US, where people's importance is measured by some kind of system of numbers on balance sheets? Well, we're going to hear from that in just a minute, an interview by C.S. Soong of Against the Grain, of geography professor Richard Peat, on the rise of finance capital. Now that is the best part of an hour, but we are going to find time to continue with our reading of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years, which I think ties all this quite neatly together, and was the inspiration for the themes of this week's show. Now, thank you to Against the Grain for this interview. If you'd like to hear more from them, you can go to their website at againstthegrain.org. And this interview is from earlier this month.
Corporate capitalism has been around for a long time, but according to my guest Richard Peat, a new era is at hand, an era of global finance capitalism. Finance capitalism was produced by a policy regime called neoliberalism. It differs, Peat argues, from industrial capitalism in important ways. So when did finance capital take over, and what are its principal features and contradictions? And how is the emergence of financial capitalism related to growing income and wealth inequality in this country and abroad? Richard Peat is professor of geography at Clark University and author of Unholy Trinity, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO. He's written articles about finance capitalism and its contradictions for Monthly Review magazine and the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economy, and Society. When Richard joined me from his office at Clark University in Massachusetts, I asked him where the term finance capitalism comes from.
Well, a number of Marxist and neo-Marxist theories have used the term. There's a guy called a great name, Rudolf Hilferding. Isn't that a super name? That wrote on it in the turn of the 20th century when the first signs of concentration of capital were appearing. And then more recently, people like David Harvey, who's a Marxist geographer, has used it. So it's a term that's been used several times, and it refers to times when capitalism goes through a period when the financial part of it becomes hegemonic and leading and powerful, etc.
So how did Hilferding, how did he define finance capital, and what did he see finance capital doing at the time he wrote?
Yeah, he was just referring to capital in large corporations, cartels, banks, and he saw these as globally dominant.
And in fact, he distinguished finance capitalism from what he called liberal capitalism. Was that what he saw as an earlier stage, which had somehow morphed into finance capitalism?
Yeah, by liberal capitalism, most of these people mean late 19th century industrial capitalism, when monopolies were just beginning to form, but there was still a large economy of small industrial producers competing against each other. And then opposed to that, you get these gigantic banking-type operations starting to emerge. And so he thought that was a really new phenomenon.
Did he see finance capitalism as being opposed to intervention by the state, or did it welcome that kind of intervention?
You know, a lot of people disagree on this, and Hilferding, I think, and myself, by the way, we don't see finance capitalism being opposed to the state. We see it as being integrated into the state, controlling the state, using the power of the state to increase its own banking power. You know, it makes a lot of difference to the form that the analysis takes as to how you see the relationship between finance capitalism and the state.
And we'll talk about more of this as the hour goes by. You write that we are now in an era of global finance capitalism. Is this a form of corporate capitalism that has existed before? I'm wondering, you know, Hilferding obviously believed that some version, some form of finance capitalism occurred back at the turn of the 20th century as the 19th century turned into the 20th century. What is your feeling?
It's always been there. There's always been a very powerful financial aspect to capitalism, but it was subordinate to industrial capitalism until quite recently, except for these outbursts like Hilferding was talking about. You know, by industrial capitalism, you basically mean the domination of production by multinational corporations. And as a Marxist, I have to say that the form that exploitation takes is the exploitation of workers during the production process. That is, you know, we actually think that ordinary people, by their hard work, create the value of commodities, and that multinational corporations can suck that out of labor and accumulate it. So it's mainly multinational industrial corporations with the banking sector, powerful, but serving the interests of these big multinational corporations who were their customers, and they lent them money and dealt with the financial aspects, etc. But in the 1990s, you get a transition from industrial corporations to multinational global financial corporations as the leading actors in contemporary capitalism. And that's the period of finance capitalism most interests me.
Now, a lot of people will say we are in what's called the neoliberal era. So part of what I want to investigate with you is the relationship between neoliberalism and finance capitalism. Maybe we can begin with your naming neoliberalism a policy regime. A policy regime, you write, is broader than a set of specific policies. Tell us more.
It's a little confusing, the relationship between finance capitalism and neoliberal policy, but let me try and explicate it. So I think that what caused the contemporary dominance of finance capitalism is this long period of neoliberal policy. And by a policy regime, I don't mean a specific policy, you know, like a certain form of regulation. I mean a whole approach by the state to making a set of policies that have profound influences on the structure of the economy, profound enough, indeed, to cause the rise of finance capitalism. And I see there have been three main policy regimes in the last 100 years or so: classical liberalism in the late 19th century, then a period of Keynesianism in the United States, and Keynesian social democracy in Western Europe in the post-World War II period, and then the 1970s, a transition, and then a new period of liberalism. So neoliberalism means new liberalism, starting in the late 1970s, around 1980, to the contemporary time.
And remind us, what were the principal characteristics and features and tendencies of the Keynesian policy regime?
Under Keynesianism, it was, Keynes was really the only major economist to recognize that capitalism has to be managed by the state. There has to be state intervention. And so it was a period when the state intervened to regulate and manage the capitalist production system. And also, even in the United States, which is hardly a kind of a radical left-wing country, quite a lot of income redistribution from taxing wealthy people and providing income support and social services to a limited degree to poor people. So it's a period when the state intervenes and the working class and poor people and oppressed people benefit somewhat from the capitalist system. In Western Europe, I grew up in England, and we had a much deeper system of intervention that I call social democracy, in which, believe it or not, we actually had free healthcare, we had grants to go to university, working class kids like me, you know, could afford to go to university, etc., etc. Far more extensive. We had state ownership of key industries, etc. In the United States, we're mainly dealing with, like, Keynesian management of an essentially capitalist system.
And what happened to incomes and wealth during the Keynesian period?
Under classical liberalism, you had a high degree of inequality when the richest 1% were making between 15 and 25% of total income. Under Keynesianism, this comes down to 8 or 9% for a period of like 30 years. And then dramatically starting in 1980, as soon as Ronald Reagan walks into that office, you see that income going to the rich, rising again to 15, 20, even almost 25%. So what happens is that liberalism and neoliberalism produce extreme inequality, and especially inequality in terms of very high income flows to rich people. And Keynesianism restricts it somewhat to around like 10% going to 1%, the richest 1%.
And when you say 10%, you mean that's the percentage of total income going to people with the highest income, correct?
It's 10% of total income going to the richest 1%, the highest income 1%, yeah.
Now, what happened in the 1970s to spur the transition from Keynesianism and social democracy, that policy regime, to the neoliberal policy regime?
Well, the conventional argument is that Keynesianism came into a crisis that it couldn't resolve, and the crisis was a crisis of stagflation. That is a mixture of stagnation, high unemployment rates, and inflation, that is a rapid increase in prices. And if you stimulated the economy, you got more inflation, and if you restricted the economy, you got more stagnation. And the idea is that Keynesianism couldn't handle it, and a lot of people then have a very kind of functional theory of so it had it. So you had to change, and you had to change to a more market-oriented system called neoliberalism. I'm skeptical of that because actually the crisis of the late 1970s and 1980s was solved by Reagan having the biggest budget deficits ever in history by a kind of military Keynesianism. So I just don't buy it. I think there was a very broad reaction against leftist tendencies, against people who were like rebellious against the American system. Look at us when we were at Berkeley. We were on the streets all the time, you know. Look at hippies. They actually gave up on consumption, right? It's a more broad political cultural shift which focuses on stagflation as one moment of it. Then you have a lot of think tank activities financed by big capital. So a lot of ideas thought up by leading intellectuals that were against Keynes and for neoliberalism. And finally, capital realizes that it really has to control the state and starts to buy the state through campaign contributions and lobbying. So it's a broad set of forces that is excused by this stagflation, but actually was a broad set of cultural and political forces that led to the rise of contemporary neoliberalism.
Another argument is that in the 70s and early 80s, corporate profits began to go down. There was more competition from international competitors, and workers had been getting steadily growing wages in the post-war period, and therefore something had to happen there. Or I shouldn't say had to happen, but that corporations and management and capitalists responded to this crisis in profitability by encouraging and spurring a new kind of policy regime. What do you think of that argument?
Profits had not decreased, but certainly flattened out in the late 1970s. And corporations definitely wanted a state regime, a policy regime more amenable to them. And as neoliberalism came in the early 1980s, you see corporate profits indeed increasing excruciatingly quickly. You know, from levels of like $200 billion a year to $1,800 billion a year over a 25-year period is an enormous increase. Now, yes, corporations had a lower rate of profit. It doesn't give them the right to then completely change the society, especially a society that was for a while giving decent incomes to poor people just because they, you know, weren't making so much profit.
What you were saying earlier is that with neoliberalism, the richest got richer, and a lot of people in the middle class and below the middle class lost ground because more and more of total income was going to the richest sectors of U.S. society and other capitalist societies. How do we account for that?
We account for it in Marxist terms, for example, in a change in the class struggle, and that capital was able to prevail over labor because industrial labor was being decimated, because unions were disappearing, because the unions that were still there were decreased in significance and power. It's just an ability to exploit labor more on the one hand. Now, finance capital, in my theory, exploits in a different way. It gets its money from a different source. And so you had an increase in corporate profits, A, from multinational corporations in their kind of usual way exploiting labor all over the world. But finance capital, I think, exploits differently, and it exploits through debt peonage. That is, it is a function of finance capital to get people into debt as deeply as it can manage to do so. What finance capital essentially wants is that every purchase be made on maxed out credit cards, so that finance capital, just in the normal commercial banks, what it does is it gets money for 1.5 to 2%, and it lends it to you for 20%. In fact, we just got an offer 27%, and it makes the difference in that 20-something percent there. And that is the new form of exploitation. It's ripping people off out of their consumption.
You list the owners and the agents in this era of finance capitalism. So, for example, the owners are super wealthy families, CEOs, upper managers, entrepreneurs. The agents, so these are the wealth production agents, I take it, are investment bankers, bond traders, brokers, private bankers, wealth managers, investment analysts. Let's just take investment banks because they seem to be a prominent player in this new era, this relatively new era. What do investment banks do?
Investment banking was separated from commercial banking by the Glass-Steagall Act in the 1930s. So it's a more specialized form of banking in the United States than it is, for example, in Britain because of this state legislation. An investment bank takes usually large deposits from wealthy families, from pension funds, from insurance companies, with the promise that it will yield a high return. And then investment banks make fairly conventional loans to corporations, but it also goes heavily into sophisticated devices, you know, like, say, futures trading, for example, that are highly risky. But the investment bank promises that it can handle that risk. It has the information, it has the expertise. And if you can handle risk, you can make a ton of money. So an investment bank's involved in very sophisticated financial operations, as well as somewhat conventional loans to, say, corporations, to cities, et cetera, et cetera. They also do things like IPOs, initial public offerings. So, for example, we've had a couple of really, you know, the Facebook example is one of a investment bank making Facebook go public, charging an enormous fee, and screwing up royally in doing so.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, financial operations like that, but especially the kind of the use of even the creation of new financial markets that the investment bank knows better than anyone else and especially in the first few years of those new markets, very high rates of profit can be made. And essentially what it does is then return those profits to people who are already super wealthy to begin with.
Don't these banks and other institutions, don't they understand that if they take ever greater risk, that it could all disappear? I mean, we've seen scandals and revelations recently where billions of dollars have been lost in trading by even one individual in an investment bank, in a global bank. So don't they understand that risk can really hurt them even in the short term?
Yeah, I mean, that's their business, though, is to manage risk. And they all claim to be able to do it better than the others. They're forced into those very risky enterprises by the huge amount of money that they have to manage. The amounts of money going through the banking, especially investment banking system, is far beyond the contemporary needs for, you know, high productivity type investing in useful innovation. The amounts of money are truly enormous. When you get, for example, just when you get 24% of the total income produced by a society going to 1% of the population who can't possibly consume that money, can't possibly use that money, even if they try really hard, you know, $200 bottle of wine for lunch, right? That great washes of money go through the investment banking system, and all they can do with it is speculate. And to attract the money, they have to offer high rates of return. If they don't offer a high rate of return, then wealthy people, and even, I'm afraid, unions, etc., won't give it to them, won't put it under their hands. They give it to whoever offers the highest rate of return. To get a high rate of return, you've got to take enormous risks. So I'm arguing that taking dangerous risks is structurally inherent to finance capitalism, and so structurally inherent that while it may diminish for a couple of years, it'll resume again, and we see exactly that happening right now.
And since risks can go awry, as we all know, does that mean that crises are also inherent, are structurally inherent within finance capitalism?
Yeah. So what happened after 2007 is that very risky investments went bust, particularly in the housing market. You know, when you had house prices going for a house, say, that used to be $200,000 became $600,000-$700,000. Obviously, that kind of housing bubble couldn't last. And when it burst, it took a lot of capital down with it. Not only people who own houses, which is bad enough, but huge amounts of capital were lost in that phase. And that's the financial component of the present crisis, and that will recur. If you continue to make those highly risky investments, you're going to have bubbles bursting and financially induced crises occurring regularly.
Can you enlighten us on what commodity futures are and what you mean by price gouging? You emphasize that in a number of your writings.
Yeah. A commodity future, at one time, was highly useful, functional market, and it essentially means buying in advance the right to purchase, say, a certain amount of oil. So you can buy, say, 3 months in advance, and you can buy it at a certain price, and it just guarantees that you'll at least be able to get oil for that price 3 months down the road. And so originally, the, you know, oil markets and futures markets were perfectly, you know, normal parts of business activity. And then maybe 10, 15 years ago especially, it starts to become an area where you can make a lot of money. So essentially what, say, investment banks do is when they see a political event on the horizon that could cause not panic, but certain worry about the future price of oil, is that they then buy oil at a low price in anticipation of its price going up because of fears of these, you know, disruptive political events. And then when the price goes up, they sell the right, they sell the contract, and they make the difference between the low price they paid and the high price that they receive. Now, the trouble is that this happens at such a scale that it greatly exaggerates the price increase that probably would have occurred anyway, but say the price of oil would have gone from, say, $80 a barrel to $85 a barrel, what you can do with betting on it is you can make it go from $80 a barrel to $100 a barrel. So what happens is everybody pays a lot more money at their gas pump. And so we have people at all types of income brackets all over the world paying more money for a vital commodity like oil simply because investment banks and other wealth managers bet on oil futures. And that's what I call price gouging. That is increasing the price artificially to rip off consumers in the interest of making profit.
Richard Peet joins us on Against the Grain, P-E-E-T. He teaches geography at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. And we are talking about two articles he wrote recently. One appeared in Monthly Review magazine. It's called Contradictions of Finance Capitalism. And the other appeared in the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economy and Society. And that one was entitled Inequality, Crisis, and Austerity in Finance Capitalism. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to Richard's faculty page at Clark, as well as to the Monthly Review article that I just mentioned. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write, Richard, that under finance capitalism, production, consumption, economy, culture, and the use of environments are subject to a more removed, more abstract calculus of power. Elaborate on that for us.
So what I'm arguing is that whereas multinational corporations that are involved in industrial production have some day-to-day, hands-on relationship with productive activity, with marketing, with consumption, etc., finance capital sits in a few centers in the global system, a few mighty cities of power, Wall Street, City of London, Frankfurt, etc., and it gazes on the world from a distance, and all it cares about is profit opportunities. So the gaze of the investment analysts, you know, is like this totally cynical look on the world that reduces it merely to like numbers and profit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this I find extremely dangerous. It's dangerous because you can destroy production systems, you can destroy currencies, you can destroy the environment from the use of this gaze.
But wasn't that always the critique of any capitalist firm, even under industrial capitalism, that, you know, the focus was always on profits and rewarding shareholders?
Yeah, and all I'm talking about is an exaggeration of a long-existing tendency. I'm just saying this happens in an even more remote, removed, calculating way when you have finance capital controlling multinational corporations, investing in multinational corporations, but also investing in futures, investing in credit default swaps, doing hedge funds, etc. So productive investment has to compete with very esoteric financial investment. And productive investment has to fulfill the profit requirements of finance capitalism. So productive activities, productive institutions, multinational corporations, have to simply make that money that will satisfy the enormous appetite of finance capital. It's the same tendency, but it's exaggerated and it's worsened, and in my opinion, it's an extremely dangerous attitude towards the world.
Now, you've written about when financial corporations began to achieve a certain kind of hegemony over industrial firms, and I guess this relates to like the percentage of all corporate profits made by manufacturing corporations versus financial corporations. Can you lay that out? I guess beginning maybe before the 1980s, manufacturing corporations were, what, making most corporate profits?
Yeah. Say 40% would come from manufacturing and maybe 15% or so would come from finance. And what you find is a slow rise in the amount of the percent of total corporate profits made by financial corporations starts to rise. And during the 1980s, and as neoliberalism comes in, finance starts to compete quite effectively with industrial corporate profits. And the two are more or less equal for quite a long period of time, from, say, the late 1980s through to the middle, late 1990s. And then starting in 1998, 1999, financial corporate profits escalate very rapidly. And manufacturing corporate profits actually decrease in the early 2000s. And so now, financial corporate profits are far higher than manufacturing corporate profits.
Would you say, Richard, that the advent of neoliberalism, the arrival of neoliberalism on the scene in around 1980 or so, made inevitable the dominant position of financial corporations, made inevitable the rise of finance capitalism?
Yeah, I would, yeah. I think it was structurally necessary. That is, the amount of income flowing to rich people that they then lent out to be managed by wealth companies was so enormous that it made inevitable the rise of whatever institutions that money was put in, and that money was put into banking, investment banking, hedge funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a secular change in the distribution of income, especially the huge amount of money going to super rich people, that makes inevitable the rise of the people that serve them, the agents that serve them, which are financial corporations.
You know, we often hear that the Democratic Party, Richard, is the party in part of organized labor. Now, with the advent of finance capitalism, is this still true?
It is indeed the party in part of organized labor, but a decreasing part. As organized labor decreases in size, for example, manufacturing employment has gone from 20 million to 11 million in a period of 15, 20 years. And as organized labor decreases because of deunionization, organized labor simply doesn't have that tremendous controlling power that they could influence the Democratic Party. And the person who finally realized this most fully was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was heavily integrated into Wall Street. Robert Rubin was his Secretary of the Treasury, and Robert Rubin was a leading figure in New York financial capitalism. And so what you get then from the 1997-1998 is an increasing support of the Democratic Party by finance capitalism. Now, many of these people who are finance capitalists can be actually politically liberal. Many of these guys are members of the Sierra Club. They're environmentalists. So they actually can fit, even in the sense of conventional liberalism, into the Democratic Party. But they are forced to serve the major interests of finance capital as their predominant form of activity. So you get a lot of influence of finance capital in the Democratic Party. I think what's happening right now is we have a major finance capitalist out of Bain Capital, a person who doesn't only represent finance capital, but is a finance capitalist, made his money in finance capitalism, getting finance capital support back to its traditional base, which is the Republican Party. And with the Democratic Party still trying to get some support from finance capital, because they have to, because they're forced to, but finance capital can be dividing its support, and if anything, going in a rightward direction towards the Romney-led Republican Party.
Wouldn't you think, Richard, that a message of opposition to finance capital, telling us, for example, reminding us what finance capital has done to our pocketbooks over the last 6 years and far beyond, that that kind of message would have populist appeal?
It would have populist appeal. It does have populist appeal, and the Democratic Party uses it, hints at it, kind of says it. But in the end, if you rely on finance capital for a large percent of your campaign contributions, and if finance capital is powerfully lobbying Congress and the Senate within the expenditure of enormous amounts of money, you can only hint. You can't go full out. You can't, for example, say that the only way to stop financially induced recessions from occurring is to restrict the power our finance capital and to take money away from super rich people through progressive taxation. You can't say that because you would be attacking the financial base of your political campaign.
Are you suggesting that the capitalist class somehow buys the government?
The American government is the most corrupt government on earth. Not in terms, you know, of paying off the cops, but in terms of the cost of buying the government. To run an effective campaign for president, in the end, you've got to be able to raise $1 billion. And the question is, where do you get $1 billion? And the answer is, from people who have $1 billion. That means super wealthy people. And if you hurt, if you criticize the super wealthy and their financial capitalist agents too much, they're not going to support you. They're not going to provide the absolutely vital, huge amounts of money that you need to buy attack ads, to have a viable position in a presidential campaign. So I'm saying, yes, political campaigns in the United States are between candidates, each of which serves the wealthy. And what we do in contemporary democracy is to support either one rich, wealthy people's candidate or the other rich, wealthy candidate.
And I want to get back to this question of state intervention and whether neoliberalism and finance capitalism welcome it. Because, you know, we hear all these arguments that, hey, government needs to get out of business, you know, that laissez-faire capitalism and capitalism freed from state regulation, for example, is the way to go. So is it correct to say that neoliberalism rejects state intervention in the economy or rejects it to a further degree than past policy regimes?
What it does is redirect state intervention. On the one hand, it redirects state intervention away from the regulation of environmental relations, of productive relations, of productive conditions, etc. So it relieves finance corporations and multinational corporations of what is always called red tape and allows them to operate as freely as possible. But what it does do also is use the power of the state to intervene on the side of finance capital when finance capital comes into difficulty. And what we just saw, especially 2007, 2008, 2009, is massive state intervention on the side of finance capital. What we saw in 2008 and 2009 was ordinary taxpayers who had already been ripped off by corporations, then rescuing them through the taxation system. So, no, it's not a withdrawal of the state from the economy. It's a redirection of state intervention away from, quote, red tape and towards rescuing finance capital, helping finance capital, being on the side of finance capital, et cetera, et cetera.
A lot of people on the left are pining for a return of at least that kind of state intervention called Keynesianism. So, you know, stimulate the economy, enable and encourage consumers to go out and buy more stuff, and that, the argument goes, will spur job creation and push wages up. What do you think of that argument?
Well, it's a good argument, and indeed it should be tried. It has one massive problem, and that problem is that we have a disarticulated economy. What I mean by a disarticulated economy is an economy in opposition to an articulated economy. An articulated economy has manufacturing, it has service, it has research, it has education, etc. And the various sectors of the economy relate to each other and feed into each other so that, for example, if you have an articulated economy, you purchase in one sector of it and it will have a multiplier effect in other sectors. So, you know, you purchase, say, a refrigerator, and they're made in the United States. Then refrigerator companies make more money. They employ people. Those people spend the money, say, on education, etc. So you have a multiplier effect where an increase in purchasing feeds through the entire economy and is capable of generating growth and jobs, etc. If you have a huge chunk of the economy missing because it's been allowed to migrate elsewhere in global space, then you, let's take again the example of buying a refrigerator. So you go to Sears, you know, you say, President Obama, I'm going to be a dutiful citizen. I'm going to even max out my credit card more than I could possibly afford to do. Mm. And I'm going to go to Sears and buy a refrigerator. Sears do okay. Maybe they employ a couple more people in trucking in refrigerators. But the multiplier effect goes to wherever the refrigerator is made. And how many refrigerators are made in the United States? The answer is almost zero, because they're all made in China. So spending money in the United States creates economic growth. But it creates economic growth in China, where they don't need it anymore, because they've already been growing at the rate of 9%. Where more economic growth, in many ways, is like unwelcome, certainly unneeded. What you need is an articulated economy in countries like the United States, so that spending benefits the whole economy, has a multiplier effect on the entire economy. So I say what we have is a leaky multiplier. That is, the effects of the multiplier leak out. So yeah, it's all we can do, but it's not very effective.
But capitalist elites, they must know that when they tell Americans to be good Americans and good consumers and go out and buy, they must know that this happens, that that kind of spending doesn't necessarily lead to growth in the U.S. economy per se.
But they do fine out of Chinese production because they own large sectors of it. I mean, finance capital makes money on economic production all over the world. It doesn't care whether it's in the United States or not. It may pretend to care for political reasons, but it's going to make money out of the globalized system anyway. Global finance capital does well out of global production and global unevenness and global problems. That's how it makes its money.
Austerity. So austerity is one response. It seems to be the dominant response to the fiscal, financial, economic crises we've all endured and will continue to endure for years to come. What basically is the message of austerity?
The message of austerity is a message that punishes the working class. What it essentially says is, so we have a government deficit, sometimes an international deficit between states and states. What is the source of this deficit? Why do governments have large deficits? And the answer is always because they spend too much. And they spend too much, for example, on social programs. So the way out of an austerity situation is to spend less on social programs that benefit the working class. It's an interpretation that is utterly prevalent. You hardly hear the reverse argument. So what we have then is a whole like discourse, a whole interpretive schema in which austerity is blamed on too much state spending, and it's the working class and poor people who really need government services that are punished during austerity programs. What you have to ask is, what is the real source of government deficits?
And what is that?
The other possible source of government deficits is that governments aren't taking in enough in taxation to support their spending on social programs. And that's the real source. And that's why, you know, you have a deficit. And what has essentially happened is the rate of marginal taxation on wealthy people, that even in the United States used to be 80% on the highest, you know, the last amount of income earned, has been decreased and decreased down to 35, 25, and in the case of capital gains, 15%. So that, for example, what Romney didn't do is show his tax returns, because his tax returns would show he's paying 13%. One of the richest people in the country is paying 13%. It's people like Romney should be heavily taxed, and they should be taxed at the rate of 90% on the fifth million income they make each year. And by taxing the wealthy, you can give social services and you can eliminate the budget deficit. But by the way, that's a very unpopular statement, and it's a statement that Obama, for example, cannot make because of its political consequences.
Well, the counterargument is always, and we hear this all the time, you know, you tax the rich, if you tax corporations at a high rate, then there will be less investment, that rich folks will spend less, they'll buy less, they'll contribute less to the economy, they'll create fewer jobs. Your response?
They should be spent. They should be investing less, because they're investing in speculation. That's exactly the reason you want to tax that money away from them, because they're not spending on productive investment and creating jobs. They're spending on speculation and creating instability. One major reason for taxing rich people is to stop them being so foolish, to stop their wealth managers being so foolish in highly risky investments. It's better that you put that money through the state and that money goes through things like education, healthcare, etc. It produces a far steadier, much saner, and certainly more ethical economy than to allow rich people to retain those huge swaths of income and have that money go into speculation. There could be nothing better for an economy, in even producing jobs, than less money going into the bank accounts of rich people.
So what do you make of what seemed like momentum away from austerity in Europe, for example, with the election of François Hollande as the president of France in May, what appeared to be at one point strong Greek resistance to austerity measures that were being imposed on it? What do you make of what appeared to be at least some strong resistance to austerity?
Yeah, well, you've got very powerful institutions like the European Bank, like the German banks, like the German government, imposing austerity on what they happily call the pigs. That is Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Imposing austerity on the states in those countries. And what you got, for example, particularly in Greece, is massive urban working class resistance to that imposition of austerity. And so what you've got is a kind of a class warfare between finance and its institutions and the people who support global finance on the one hand, who are for austerity, and the masses, the hundreds of thousands of working class people who, to protect themselves from austerity measures, are prepared to go on the street, be clubbed, be gassed, even be shot in opposition to it. And that class struggle is still going on, and that class struggle is not over.
And finally, do you see a time when conditions that prevailed in the U.S. in the few decades after World War II might prevail again, when corporate profits are fairly high and for some reason a government comes into power that is actually interested in full employment or fuller employment, is interested in workers getting better wages, or at least tolerates that situation? Do you see that kind? Because that seems to be a kind of golden age of capitalism. Certainly there was exploitation and there was class struggle and a lot of people were suffering. But you know, when leftists look at the broad sweep of U.S. history, they see, at least during that time, a relative peace between management and labor and some gains made by workers. Do you see such a situation returning anytime soon?
I wish I did. I'd like to, and I contribute to it, and I talk about it every day, and I use every ounce of my own personal energy to try and create a day like that. I'm afraid we have to get worse before there's a potential for that kind of system to be seriously considered again. We've got to go through years of crisis and contradiction, financial crisis, environmental crisis, crisis of production, to produce an awakened people and a more informed people. I think people are like scared. I think they're mesmerized by consumption. They're doing the best to lead something of a satisfactory life as quietly as they can. When working class consciousness is aroused, it tends to go in the Tea Party direction because that's the propaganda that they get. We have to go through a series of crises that threaten human existence before we can emerge on the other side.
Was the great global economic meltdown that began in 2007, was that the kind of crisis, or was that the scale of the kind of crisis that you're hoping for, or that you're thinking is a necessary precondition to creating something new?
Yeah, I'm not hoping for it because people will really suffer.
Right.
The thing is, this crisis has been smoothed over and managed with great consequence with enormous pain for people who've lost their houses, lost their jobs, etc. But because the essential causes of this crisis are still there, then it will repeat. And it might, you know, it'll repeat at a higher level and really test the powers of the state and the taxation system to rescue finance capital from its stupid mistakes, maybe two or three times before it reaches that level where truly fundamental crisis occurs. Now, if this corresponds with an environmental crisis, then we're talking about, you know, momentous problems that can only be resolved by a more rational, sensible, politically aware population.
Richard Peet, P-E-E-T, professor of geography at Clark University. You might want to check out his book, Geography of Power, The Making of Global Economic Policy, or Unholy Trinity, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO. Again, we've got links to Richard and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
And now we continue with our reading of the final chapter of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And we pick up where we left off last week with David Graeber noting the rise of debt after the ascent of corporate capital and the way in which the systemic pressures that profit from putting people into debt are ignored in favor of blaming the victims and emphasizing the moral aspect of people getting into debt. There is something profoundly deceptive going on here. All these moral dramas start from the assumption that personal debt is ultimately a matter of self-indulgence, a sin against one's loved ones, and therefore that redemption must necessarily be a matter of purging and restoration of ascetic self-denial. What's being shunted out of sight here is first of all the fact that everyone is now in debt. U.S. household debt is now estimated at, on average, 130% of income, and that there's very little of this debt has accrued by those determined to find money to bet on horses or toss away on fripperies. Insofar as it was borrowed, for what economists like to call discretionary spending, it was mainly given to children to share with friends, or otherwise to be able to build and maintain relations with other human beings that are based on something other than sheer material calculation. One must go into debt to achieve a life that goes in any way beyond sheer survival. Now, I can't let this go unremarked because I think this is an uncharacteristic lapse on David Graeber's part. It's a very forward-thinking and generally well-researched book, in my opinion, but on this point I know he's wrong because, as we heard on the show, there are people who don't use money. I spoke to somebody last December who said when he did get some money from an inheritance, he was jolly glad to get shot of it because he felt weird buying things and he just preferred the moneyless gift economy life. So yeah, there's certainly a huge apparatus trying to get you into debt, but that isn't necessarily to say that you must go into debt to live a sociable life. Insofar as there is a politics here, it seems a variation on a theme seen since the dawn of capitalism. Ultimately, it's sociality itself that's treated as abusive, criminal, demonic. To this, most ordinary Americans, including Black and Latino Americans, recent immigrants and others who were formerly excluded from credit, have responded with a stubborn insistence on continuing to love one another. They continue to acquire houses for their families, liquor and sound systems for parties, gifts for friends. They even insist on continuing to hold weddings and funerals, regardless of whether this is likely to send them skirting default or bankruptcy, apparently figuring that, as long as everyone now has to remake themselves as miniature capitalists, why shouldn't they be allowed to create money out of nothing too? Granted, the role of discretionary spending itself should not be exaggerated. The chief cause of bankruptcy in America is catastrophic illness. Most borrowing is simply a matter of survival, and if one doesn't have a car, one can't work, and increasingly, simply being able to go to college now almost necessarily means debt peonage for at least half one's subsequent working life. Still, it's useful to point out that for real human beings, survival is rarely enough. Nor should it be. By the 1990s, The same tensions had begun to reappear on a global scale, as the older penchant for loaning money for grandiose state-directed projects like the Aswan Dam gave way to an emphasis on microcredit. Inspired by the success of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, the new model was to identify budding entrepreneurs in poor communities and provide them with small, low-interest loans. Credit, the Grameen Bank insisted, is a human right. At the same time, the idea was to draw on the social capital, the knowledge, the networks, connections, and ingenuity that the poor people of the world are already using to get by in difficult circumstances, and convert it into a way of generating even more expansive capital, able to grow at 5 to 20% annually. As anthropologists like Julia Eliachar discovered, the result is double-edged. As one unusually candid NGO consultant explained to her in Cairo in 1995, quote, "Money is empowerment. This is empowerment money. You need to be big, need to think big. Borrowers here can be imprisoned if they don't pay, so why be worried? In America, we get 10 offers for credit cards in the mail every day. You pay incredible real interest rates for that credit, something like 40%, but the offer is there. So you get the card, you stuff your wallet full of credit cards, you feel good. It should be the same thing here. Why not help them to get into debt? Do I really care what they use the money for, as long as they pay the loan back?" Unquote. The very incoherence of the quote is telling. The only unifying theme seems to be, people ought to be in debt. It's good in itself. It's empowering. Anyway, if they end up too empowered, we can also have them arrested. Debt and power, sin and redemption, become almost indistinguishable. Freedom is slavery. Slavery is freedom. During her time in Cairo, Eliachar witnessed young graduates of an NGO training program go on strike for their right to receive startup loans. At the same time, just about everyone involved took it for granted that most of their fellow students, not to mention everyone else involved in the program, was corrupt and exploiting the system as their personal cash cow. Here, too, aspects of economic life that had been based on long-standing relations of trust were, through the intrusion of credit bureaucracies, becoming effectively criminalized. Within another decade, the entire project, even in South Asia where it began to appear suspiciously similar to the US subprime mortgage crisis. All sorts of unscrupulous lenders piled in, all sorts of deceptive financial appraisals were passed off to investors, interest accumulated, borrowers tried to collectively refuse payment, lenders began sending in goons to seize what little wealth they had, corrugated tin roofs, for example, and the end result has been an epidemic of suicides by poor farmers caught in traps from which their families could never possibly escape. Just as in the 1945-75 cycle, this new one culminated in another crisis of inclusion. It proved no more possible to really turn everyone in the world into micro-corporations or to democratize credit in such a way that every family that wanted to could have a house. And if you think about it, if we have the means to build them, why shouldn't they? Are there families who don't deserve houses? Than it had been to allow all wage labourers to have unions, pensions, and health benefits. Capitalism doesn't work that way. It's ultimately a system of power and exclusion. And when it reaches the breaking point, the symptoms recur, just as they had in the 1970s, food riots, oil shock, financial crisis, the sudden startled realisation that the current course was ecologically unsustainable, attendant apocalyptic scenarios of every sort. In the wake of the subprime collapse, the US government was forced to decide who really gets to make money out of nothing, the financiers or ordinary citizens. The results were predictable. Financiers were bailed out with taxpayer money, which basically means that their imaginary money was treated as if it were real. Mortgage holders were overwhelmingly left to the tender mercies of the courts under a bankruptcy law that Congress had, a year before, rather suspiciously presciently, one might add, made far more exacting against debtors. Nothing was altered. All major decisions were postponed. The great conversation that many were expecting never happened. We live now at a genuinely peculiar historical juncture. The credit crisis has provided us with a vivid illustration of the principle set out in the last chapter, that capitalism cannot really operate in a world where people believe it will be around forever.